Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen. I'm Peter Flanagan, a member of the board of the Manhattan Institute, and on the behalf of the board, I welcome you all here. About 40 years ago, when I was joining the White House staff of President Nixon, I made as a first stop the office of Bryce Harlow, who was then considered the noblest and wisest of Washington operators. And Bryce was in the business of putting together a congressional relations staff for the White House. The proof of his wisdom was that he chose for Senate relations a young Tennessean who's with us today. And that was when I first met Lamar Alexander and developed a friendship that has existed since then. Lamar got his law degree here in New York, which gave him an appreciation of our fair city. After his White House stint, his varied career included running for and getting elected as governor of Tennessee. And in the process of getting elected, he walked 1,000 miles across the state of Tennessee in his red plaid shirt and played Alexander's ragtime band on the piano as many times as he had walked miles. He was a great governor, much acclaimed, but unfortunately, the magic of the plaid shirt and Alexander's ragtime band did not work so well in his two gallant runs for the presidency. After that, Lamar became the governor of the state of Tennessee. He became the president of the University of Tennessee, and more recently, happily for us, has been elected U.S. Senator. He serves as the chairman of the subcommittee, the Senate Subcommittee on Early Childhood and Education, and the Senate Energy Committee. And equally importantly, serves on the two all-important committees, Foreign Relations and the Budget. Today, Lamar is going to talk to us about restoring democracy through his Federal Consent Decree Fairness Act. And that, of course, is the subject of the Manhattan Institute's latest book, written by two of our happy band of brothers here, Messrs. Sandler and Schoenbrunn. If, after his discussion of this issue, any of you have questions on other timely subjects before the Senate, I am sure Lamar would be happy to answer them. So it is with great pleasure and pride that I introduce to you U.S. Senator Lamar Alexander.
Thank you, Peter. And thanks to all of you for coming. Peter Flanagan's got a big heart, and he's done a lot of good in his lifetime, and he has a lot more to do. And I've enjoyed knowing him and working with him. Just so you'll know that everything's in its usual excellent shape in Washington, D.C., the Capitol is being evacuated due to a power outage. I don't know whether that's electrical power or some other kind of... Senators should go to their offices in the Senate office buildings. Capitol staff should report to their assembly areas. Senate office buildings remain opening. So it's better to be in New York City, I think. We had a briefing of senators, which is almost... it's hard to imagine a briefing of senators. Senators usually talk. Senator Warner of Virginia said that when he came to the Senate, an older senator came up to him, put his arm around him and said, "There's nothing to this senator business, boy." He said, "All you have to do is just stand up, rear back, start talking, and pretty soon you'll think of something to say." So, but we were being briefed about terrorism in the Capitol last year, And they had about 70 senators down in the Senate restaurant, and the sergeant-at-arms was trying diligently to brief the senators. Of course, they were all talking to each other, not listening very well. And finally, he said that what senators should do is evacuate their offices immediately and go out to someplace. And Senator Bunning, a Hall of Fame pitcher from Kentucky, said, I'd rather die in my office than go out there. And then Senator Mikulski, a delightful, spunky person about this tall, some of you may know what the monocle is. It's a bar down the street from the Capitol. She looked at Bunning and said, I'd rather die at the monocle. So we're in full gear in the United States Congress, and I'm going to walk out at 1:30 pretty abruptly because I've got to catch a plane back. I have an amendment on the floor. The immigration debate resumes this afternoon. We can talk about that a little bit if you want. And I have an amendment about helping prospective citizens legally here become Americans, which is a passion of mine, to help them learn English, learn American history. That's an important part of any immigration debate ought to be about that. Well, this is a real joy for me, and I thank you for inviting me. You know, throughout my whole life, I've wondered at the lack of intersection between serious scholarship and political action or government policy. Too often, this great scholarship is done, the whole universities and institutes filled with people coming up with spectacular answers, which unfortunately, people whose job it is to implement the answers never hear about the research. And too often, the speeches on the Senate floor, like the one that Senator Warner had described, the issue comes up and we just stand up and start talking and eventually think of something to say. Well, this, thanks to the Manhattan Institute and two of its scholars, Ross Sandler and David Schoenbrod, is an example, I hope, of where serious scholarship, really good serious scholarship on an urgent problem that is such a nuanced and dull-sounding problem that most people wouldn't pay any attention to it, has made its way into the United States Congress and has a good chance of being enacted into law. We'll see. No one predicts what happens in the Congress. But what I thought I might do in my time was tell you the story of how this instance of serious scholarship recognized a real problem in our country, caught the attention of the Congress, and is in the legislative process with a good chance of being enacted into law. I might also disclose, in the interest of full disclosure, that it helps if the serious scholar is a roommate of the United States Senator in law school to make sure that intersection. Ross Sandler and I were at NYU together back in the early 60s, but there are lots of members of Congress interested in this, thanks to the Manhattan Institute's work. And what I would like to compliment you before I begin about the work is that in working with this, with other senators and other congressmen, there are two sides to this issue. There are to all important issues. There are many principles that have to be considered, and it's important to be accurate. And I found this work to be accurate, and it acknowledges in many ways the other side. The issue is very simply, and I'll put it this way. The idea is to try to let people who are elected to do a job make the policy decisions without interference from courts and plaintiffs' lawyers who weren't elected to do the job. Their job should be about rights. Our job should be about policy. And this is about the issue of how federal court consent decrees have over time permitted unelected Americans to make decisions about important issues that other Americans who have been elected in a democratic process thought they were elected to make. And let me begin with a story. I was governor of Tennessee in the 1980s, and it didn't take me long to figure out that our chance to move ahead and raise family incomes and improve as a state depended to a great extent upon education. One of the biggest challenges we had at that time was changing education. So we fought for things like paying teachers more for teaching well, the first state to do that, centers of excellence. But those things took money. And we had low taxes and a limited amount of money and had to balance the budget every year. So what I worked on hard during my 8 years was to try to make sure that we spent at least half of our state tax dollars on education, and we got it up to 51 cents. But the biggest problem I had was that Medicaid costs kept rising out of control. Because the rules were set in Washington and the bills were paid in Tennessee. And every time I tried to put more money into paying good teachers more, creating a center of excellence at the University of Tennessee so St. Jude's Hospital wouldn't move or begin or improve a pre-K program or create a governor's school for outstanding teachers and students in the summer, I had to fight off. My whole task as governor was to try to keep the growth. Now, these aren't cuts. These are to keep growth of health care spending, principally Medicaid, under control. We were able to do that over 8 years and had got a lot of good results. So I'm very sensitive to the argument that a governor who has been elected or a mayor who has been elected with an assignment ought to have a chance to do it because if that person doesn't get it done, well, then the voters ought to have a chance to throw him or her out and get somebody else in there who can do the job. And just to show that we're not isolated in Tennessee in this respect, let's jump ahead 20 years. We now have a Democratic governor in Tennessee. And he's going through the same thing, although it's worse. Because when he became governor, Phil Bredesen, a few years ago, our Medicaid program, which we call 10 Care, was completely out of control. And he decided in 2004 that it was going to result in an additional $650 million in costs to the state in the 2006 budget. And he thought it should only have a $75 million increase in cost. Now, those numbers aren't as big as Washington numbers, but in Tennessee, those are big numbers. For example, a $75 million increase in cost would be enough to pay every single teacher in Tennessee about an $800 pay raise in a year. So those are real bucks in a state budget. So Governor Bredesen did what he thought he was elected to do. He came up with a plan to try to increase to control the increase in Medicaid spending. But he ran into a couple of problems, both of them federal judges. Both of them operating under federal court consent decrees that had been in place since I'd been governor, which is a long time ago. Some of them more than 20 years ago. Without going into detail, in the first case, the federal judge took a general law that Congress had passed that said there ought to be access to screening for children served under Medicaid and turned that into a specific requirement for 80% of the children to have screening 7 times. Very expensive. Good idea, very expensive. Where's the money coming from? The second thing the governor wanted to do was to cut some people off of optional services that the federal government said states may have but don't have to have, and spend that money on children and educational programs. And a second federal judge got involved and said he too would have to approve the decision, even though the governor and the legislature had agreed on it, under another federal court consent decree. And while he considered it, it took 6 months. It cost the state $43 million a year, again, each month. That's a $700 or $800 pay increase per teacher. And finally, it was approved, but that was what the governor had to go through in that case. This is happening everywhere across the country. You hear people stand up in Washington sometimes and say, the federal government's not properly funding higher education. Don't believe a word of it. Don't believe a word of it. Because I have got the facts of it here. There is some underfunding of higher education going on, but total federal spending on all higher education over a 5-year period, 2000 to 2004, is up 60%. 60%, that's big increases. Well, then why are tuitions going up so fast? And they are. Tuitions at four-year public university in the same 5 years are up 50%. That's a problem. Why is that? Because state spending on Medicaid during that time went up 36%, and state spending on higher education went up 10%. So here we are reading Tom Friedman's book about the world is flat. It's very important for all of us to keep our advantage in science and technology. We want children to learn what they can know. We want our universities to be great. Yet we have in place a quiet system, which is keeps the growth of Medicaid going up without much control, and keeps states from properly funding the higher education institutions, the community colleges, the research universities, upon which depend our future standard of living. That's what's at stake. And those were, I used to think, the kind of decisions that governors and mayors were supposed to make, that legislators and city councilmen and women were supposed to make, not unelected people, elected people. Other examples, in New York City, Herman Badillo and I were just talking about this. He was the author of the Bilingual Education Act at one time. He pointed out it was supposed to be a short-term act. And the end of it was that you're supposed to learn to speak one language. Well, in New York City, many parents have decided they'd like for their children to have what we call English as a second language. In other words, you recognize that they speak some language other than English, but as quickly as possible, you help them learn our common language. That's what most parents want for their children. Not New York City, you can't get that, because there's a federal court consent decree that's been in effect 25 years, and when those parents go before the judge and say, we want to change that, the judge says, no, he's in charge, not you. In Los Angeles, a consent decree has forced the Metropolitan Transit Authority to spend $110 million per year on improving city buses. This is another example from the book, the Manhattan Institute book. That sounds pretty good. That's 40% of the budget just on buses. But say you were elected to the city council and you noticed that not as many people were riding buses and more of the money ought to be spent on light rail, for example, or on rail improvements. But no, you can't make that decision because of the federal court consent decree. One last example. Mike Leavitt is the Secretary of Health and Human Services in Washington, D.C. He was the governor of Utah. He had never agreed to a federal court consent decree for just the problems that I am describing. His advisors told him not to, but he finally changed his mind on a foster care issue and did. But he said he would outsmart those who were proposing the decree because he would insist that there be in the decree a termination date, a sunset provision. In other words, after 4 years, it was all off. That was 1994. It's still on. This is 2006. Governor Leavitt's gone. He's in Washington. The consent decree's still on, so unelected people are making decisions that elected people should be making, even though it was expressly agreed in the consent decree that it would be over in 1998. The Supreme Court in 2004 recognized that the consent decree had gotten out of balance, and it made some suggestions about writing it. These are also mentioned carefully in the Manhattan Institute book. But this is what the court said, a couple of sentences, quote, the state officials warn that enforcement of consent decrees can undermine the sovereign interests and accountability of state governments. The concerns they express are legitimate ones, if not limited to reasonable and necessary implementation of federal law. The bottom line of that was that the Supreme Court has suggested that Congress step in and create an environment in which federal court consent decrees can be properly used. I already mentioned the pressures of federal spending. Right now you may hear that the Republican Congress is trying to cut Medicare and Medicaid. Let me mention to you what a Washington, D.C. cut is. Last year, we cut the spending of Medicaid from a growth of 41% over the next 5 years to a growth of 40%. That is a cut in Washington, D.C. terms. But under all sets of circumstances, the rate of growth of Medicare and Medicaid in Washington is completely unsustainable, will have to be changed over the next several years. And if it's still true that many of the rules are set in Washington and the bills are paid in Nashville and Albany and other state capitals, then states need more flexibility and taking their available resources and deciding whether they want to spend those on education, on foster care, on Medicare, whatever it is that they're elected to deal with. So I mentioned when I left the governor's office in 1987, we're spending 51 cents out of every dollar on education, 15 cents on health care. Today, Governor Bredesen is spending 40 cents on education, 31 cents on health care, and it's going up. I think it's hurting our education system and hurting our chance to keep our standard of living. That's why we propose what we call the Federal Consent Decree Fairness Act. It does three things. It's described in documents, which I hope you won't read right now, but I'll mention. It has some language in there about findings, a series of findings, that these consent decrees should not be too broad, should not last too long, sort of guidelines for the judges as they approve these agreements between parties, which can be very useful from time to time, but ought to be done properly. Second, it creates a sort of term limits for consent decrees. It basically says after 4 years, they stop, after 4 years they may be reviewed, or a newly elected official may come in. New mayor of the city of New York may be elected one day. He or she may come in and say, I want all of our children to have a real chance to learn English in our schools. Which means I'd rather they be in the English as a second language program and their parents want them there. He ought to be able to go into the federal court or the school board should and try to change that if that needs to be done. So, and finally, the legislation would shift the burden of proof. So it would be up to those who complained about the problem to prove it needs to be continued after 4 years or after the term limit, rather than having the newly elected mayor or newly elected governor prove a negative. We've made a lot of progress with this piece of legislation. We have 25 co-sponsors in the United States Senate. We work very hard to keep it bipartisan. It has its strongest support from people, not surprisingly, like Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska, who is a Democrat, but who, as I was a governor. Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas, a Democrat, who was a state attorney general and who've had experience with these. In the House of Representatives, the lead Democratic sponsor is Representative Jim Cooper of Nashville, includes Harold Ford of Memphis, who is the likely Democratic nominee for the United States Senate, and the principal sponsor in the House is the Republican whip, Roy Blunt. We've had hearings in both the Senate and the House. The bill is scheduled for a markup in the Senate. A markup is being considered in the House. Hopefully, the bill can be considered in the next two or three months. We've taken extra steps. This bill has been out in the full public view for a year. We had a couple of public hearings in Washington, D.C., and invited people who don't like the bill and who enjoy being a part of the unelected group that makes policy to come and point out flaws in the bill. They actually made some pretty good suggestions, and we've made some changes in the bill based upon those hearings. So it's helped a lot that the Manhattan Institute found this issue. It would languish down there. People don't just get on the subway every day and say, "How do you feel about the consent decree?" You know, they don't even say that much on the Senate floor. But they brought this out. They brought it out in a balanced way that includes comments from John Sexton, president of New York University, Bill Bradley, Ed Koch, the president of the ACLU. Diane Ravitch, a broad group of people from both sides who believe in federalism and who believe in democracy. So I'm here today really to salute the Manhattan Institute. And to those of you who give it money and support it, I know at least of one good thing you've done. And there are many more things that you've done as well. And to say to Ross and David, I thank you for your volunteer time, your extra time. They've been willing to come to Washington, meet with skeptical senators and congressmen, ask questions, answer questions. We're still not finished yet, but this is a good piece of work, and I'm here to congratulate you for it, and thank you for giving me a chance to be a part of it.
Thank you. As the senator said, we have to get him out of here by 1:30, but we do have some time for questions. I'd ask you just raise your hand and wait for me to acknowledge you, and then please wait for the microphone to get to you, too. Actually, why don't we start right off the bat with Michael Rebell.
Hi,
Now, Michael, this is unfair. I'm going to get Ross and David to answer the question.
Well, the question I wanted to raise actually is something that was very much emphasized in their book, which is, what is the origin of the rights upon which these consent decrees have been built? And what they point out in a very interesting way, it's no longer judicial activism based on a judge's interpretation of the Constitution. In most of these situations, it's judges interpreting acts of Congress that vest certain rights in people. And in my own case, they discussed in great detail the special education litigation we had in New York City. To the extent that the city has difficulty coming into compliance with the federal requirements there, and that was the basis for the consent decree, what I've told Ross and David repeatedly is, your beef shouldn't be with the courts, it should be with the Congress. So I'm just asking if you could comment on this question that most of these hard requirements that the states have to live with are coming from Congress, and the courts are merely enforcing them. And even the Medicaid issue that you raised, that pressure for spending on the governors is coming from the Congress, and the courts are really carrying out the intent of the law, from my point of view.
Michael, there's you have a point. I mean, I've said to my colleagues in Congress that it's, you know, we're passing the buck too often, and we're sitting up there in Washington, say, oh yeah, this sounds good. Let's have medically screening for, let's have medical screening for a child in Tennessee, and we're in effect, it's an what I would call an unfunded mandate. I used to hate those as governor. You'd be some congressman stand up, have a big idea, send the bill to me. He'd hold a press conference, take credit for it. Next day he'd be back down in Tennessee making a speech about local control. So that's a good point, that there are statutes in some cases that impose on state and local governments responsibilities without sending the money to pay for it, and that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is in some cases where judges, such as I believe they did in Tennessee, and in terms of the medical screening point for children. I think the judge took a limited statute and greatly expanded it, and that was eventually overturned by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, who agreed with that. But that slowed down the whole process, and in the same way, the other judge who felt it was wise to step in and approve whether the state had the right to cut off those who are receiving optional services and spend the money instead on mandatory services and on other programs like education. Again, the Sixth Circuit overruled that and said the judge went beyond what the statute said, but it slowed down the whole process, made it hard to get agreement, and cost the state a lot of money. So I think we do have a job in Washington to make sure that we mean what we say when we pass statutes, and if we say things that add burdens to states, we should pay for it. Now, probably, I can't speak very well about the rest of the book. I wonder if David, or if it'd be appropriate to, we won't do that. Right? I think, well, you all can talk about it afterwards. I hope that's a fair response to your question.
Henry Stern.
Governor, I agree with everything you've said, and I admire your public career. What I'd like to know is, considering how sensible this bill seems to practically everyone in this room, why is it not, as someone in Washington unfortunately said, why is it not a slam dunk to pass it? Where is the opposition to your bill? Who are the lobbyists and interest groups that don't want this these consent decrees limited?
Well, I can think of two, and I'm not their best advocate, but civil rights groups are one. If you've been involved in the civil rights movement since the 1960s, I used to clerk for Judge Wisdom in New Orleans, so I know about that. Then the federal courts are your friend, and federal judges aren't always, and elected officials aren't always your friend. During a time of segregation in the South, that was especially true. So you're very skeptical of anything that limits the power of the federal courts and plaintiffs' attorneys and increases the power of elected officials. I would just say to those in the civil rights movement that they should remember that federal district judges weren't their friend in the 1960s in the South either. But that's one group. A second group is environmental groups who've used federal court consent decrees as an aid in making broad applications that have a long continuity. And then a third is any other person who has an issue that they can't get the legislature to adopt and they want an alternative way. So if you really believe that every children don't need to learn English, that they should be taught their native language and language and the English language, and you can't get the legislature to agree with you, maybe you can get the court to agree with you. So it's a different avenue for policy. And what we have to be careful to do is to say if it's policy, that's for the elected people to decide. If it's rights, that's for the judge to decide. But those are advocacy groups. When Ross and I went to NYU Law School on a Root Tilden scholarship, we were encouraged there to be in public service, and that was defined then as serve in government. Today, public service means for many people sue the government, and people who are in that, it's a noble thing to do, but people who are in that group wouldn't like this bill most of the time.
Judith West, good afternoon, Senator.
Good afternoon.
Shifting gears to immigration. Could you tell me, I am frustrated by the lack of support within the president's party for his plan, which seems very sensible to me. What's going on in Washington?
Well, they're hearing from people at home. The people around the country are, well, let me tell you what I think should be done, then I'll try to answer your question. I think first, we should secure the border. Second, we should create a lawful status for the students and workers that we welcome to come here. And third, we should help prospective citizens become Americans. That's what I think we ought to do in a comprehensive bill. And I think we'll come pretty close to doing that before we're through. Samuel Huntington, who got famous for a couple of recent books, has been a great political scientist, and he once said that most of our politics is about a conflict of principles with which almost all of us agree. This issue, immigration, brings up most of those principles. I mean, we begin with the rule of law. It is not right for the United States to go around the world preaching about the rule of law and let 11 million people live here illegally. We should not do that. Now, we have done it, so we've got to deal with it. But we should not, I don't think, be one bit embarrassed about saying, you're not supposed to run a red light, you're not supposed to cross the border illegally, you're not supposed to violate a contract. So that's the rule of law. We've got a couple of other principles: equal opportunity, nation of immigrants, laissez-faire, free market. All of that suggests that we're wise to have a generous policy of legal status for students and workers here of all kinds. So we've got some really ridiculous provisions in the current law. I mean, if Wernher von Braun showed up today and wanted to come to the United States, we'd make him sign an affidavit said he was promised to go home. We don't want him to go home. We want him to stay here and help raise our standard of living and win our wars. The head of the three top people at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, our largest science laboratory, are green card holders. They're foreigners who are legally here from England, from Canada, and the fellow who runs the effort to recapture supercomputing worldwide for the United States is a citizen of India who is living here legally. So we don't want to give the impression that we don't recognize that it's important to have 572,000 students here and researchers. 60% of our doctorate students are foreign students. They're a big part of the reason why we have 30% of the wealth and 5% of the people in the world. They're part of our standard of living. As for workers, we need plenty of them, but they ought to be lawfully here. And then the third part is becoming American. A lot of people are pretty upset with the failure to honor the rule of law, and they have a right to be. We should never have let things go that long in that way. And so the difficult part of this whole debate is not what we do about the future, it's what we do about the 11 or 10 or 12 million people who we've already let come in, and what kind of transition do we have from wherever they are to where they're going to be. That's what the whole argument is about. And there are a lot of pretty strong feelings about it, especially along the border, but all over the country. You might be surprised to learn in a state like Tennessee, we have rural counties where 20% of the population now is Hispanic. And in our state, we've gone from about 1% Hispanic to maybe 10%. And Tennessee has no borders with any other country and no oceans. So this is a big change.
I know, Michael, I was going to get you next. I just want to make sure that we didn't. I'll say Chuck and then Michael. Thank you. Chuck Kadlec. If I may ask a quick follow-up question. My sense is part of the resentment on this issue is that there's a large part of the population that hasn't learned to speak English. And we ask little of people who want to become Americans, and one of those is that they want to speak English. And yet, every time I go to vote, I have a bilingual or multilingual ballot. So how is it that in order to be a citizen, you have to speak English, but yet our ballots for federal and state officials are multilingual?
Yeah, I don't think they should be. I'm not sure the Constitution permits it. There's a provision in the Voting Rights Act, which is expiring this year, which permits it. And I'm not sure an extension of it is constitutional. As far as English goes, in the amendment that I'm proposing tonight when I go back, I believe most people who come here want to learn English. Certainly their children do because they know it's essential to get ahead. So I think the best way to do that is to honor the common language, help people understand why we have it, and help people learn it. So I have in there $500 grants for anyone legally here who wants help learning English. It's a voucher which they can take to any accredited academic program and help them learn English. I would cut from 5 years to 4 years the amount of time you have to wait to become a citizen if you are proficient in English, not just basic in English. So in those two ways, to try to honor and encourage the common language. I've not found many. We've in our history, we've always had new Americans who've been in enclaves. I mean, the Germans did that very much over 100 years ago, wanted to speak their own language. But by the time you got to the next generation, usually people wanted to learn English. So I think the main thing we can do is make it easy and give incentives for people to learn our common language. We'll make the greatest progress that way.
Michael?
Thank you. Senator,
yes, sir.
I should remind you that Federal Judge Frank Johnson, who was a judicial activist, placed the Constitution on the side of blacks during the Civil Rights Movement.
He was a Republican as well.
That's right. That's why I reminded you.
as was Judge Wisdom and Judge Tuttle and Judge Brown. They're all great
thank
men.
Thank you very much. Now, my question.
He was from the free state of Winston, Alabama, Judge Johnson was. So his ancestors fought with the Union in Alabama, that's why they were Republicans and not Democrats.
To my question.
Excuse me.
Sandra Day O'Connor recently reminded us that there are three branches of government, the presidency, the executive, the Congress, and the judiciary. And so when you say that it's an unelected group, meaning the judges, it sounds to me like judicial bashing, because Congress has extraordinary powers over the courts. It may remove its jurisdiction over matters entirely. So when the court does have jurisdiction, the power to hear a case, civil rights activists like myself, Michael Myers of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, we do put our hackers up and say, what are you doing? The courts are there. The response to your point about consent decrees, if there is an abuse, consent decrees mean consent of the parties. Mm-hmm. The parties don't have to agree. Let it go to trial. And then let the judge make findings of fact and law, which the courts exist to do. But don't go there, make a consent, the parties agree, and then all of a sudden you don't like what is happening, and then you want to go back and then reopen it on a different set of circumstances and facts. That's my question to you. Why agree in the first place to a consent decree? You have powers of the executive, power of the Congress, of the legislator, just don't agree.
Good, very good point, Michael. And answer number one is some elected officials pass the buck and make bad decisions. and they don't want to make tough decisions about civil rights. They don't want to make tough decisions about the environment. They don't want to make tough decisions about prisons. So they say to the courts, you take it over. So it's their fault, not the judge's fault. That's a very good point. The second point is, Governor Bredesen did not agree to Governor Alexander's consent decree 25 years ago. And there ought to be a limit on how long I can my decisions and that of the Attorney General in the 80s can govern the state without a easy review. Same thing with the transportation decision in Los Angeles, and same thing with bilingual education here. I think federal court consent decrees are very useful tools, and I think it would be very important in this legislation not to keep them from being useful tools. All I'm trying to do is to make it a little easier for judges to secure rights and legislators to make policy. That's the goal.
Has to be a quick question, if anybody. No? All right, well then, thank you, Senator. Thank you. Thank you.